Hello, and welcome to the Dr. Francavilla Show. I'm your host, Dr. Carolyn Francavilla, board-certified family physician and diplomate of the American Board of Obesity Medicine. I've been helping patients lose weight to treat and prevent medical problems for the last 10 years, and I'm taking what I've learned from them to you. In this podcast, you will learn the science behind why you struggle with your weight and what to do about it, tips for common challenges, work to fight bias about what a healthy weight really is, and improve your relationship with food and your body. Please remember that while I'm a doctor, I'm not your doctor. This podcast is meant to be informational in nature only, not medical advice. Please seek out care from your physician for your specific needs. Okay, let's get started.
All right. Hello and welcome to this week's episode. Today, I have a really exciting guest with us. We have Dr. Audrey Wells. Dr. Wells is a seasoned sleep medicine physician and professional mindset coach. She's on a mission to help people with sleep apnea and insomnia get fully treated without sacrificing their comfort. She offers a comprehensive library of self-directed courses, a group coaching program, and a private Facebook community. She also does individual coaching for those who want to up-level their productivity and potential by taking too tired out of the equation. So welcome, Dr. Wells.
Thanks. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me guest.
Well, I think sleep is so key to our overall health, as well as people who are on their weight journey. Can you tell us how you got interested in sleep medicine, as well as you also do obesity medicine, right? You've done training in that. So how did you get interested in those fields?
Yeah, it's kind of a story that I think a lot of docs go through when you're trying to figure out, okay, what is my specialty going to be? Where do I want to practice? You try different stuff. And I kind of had a trial by fire. So my background is in pediatrics. That was my residency training. Then I did a pediatric pulmonary fellowship, which had a very strong ICU component, which is a little unusual for peds pulm fellowships. But at the center where I trained, we did lung transplant for kids. And so I was really into that. I thought I might kind of pursue that as my ultimate career. The problem was I started bumping up against my own personal limit for sleep deprivation and tolerance of a call schedule. And it was, you know, it was just something that I didn't cope well with. And it just so happened on a trip, I think it was in Toronto, I was at an ATS meeting, American Thoracic Society. And I was in a full day meeting for cystic fibrosis. I was falling asleep, ironically. So I got up to walk around and then I stumbled on a full day meeting for sleep medicine. And I just read the placard and I thought, wow, I am really connecting with this. So I ended up going into that meeting and spent the whole day learning about sleep disorders. And after my pulm fellowship was done, I went and did a sleep medicine fellowship and haven't looked back since.
Wow. Yeah. It is interesting how we find these things in medicine that just fascinate us. And sometimes it's based on our personal experience or a loved one's. And we're like, something about this doesn't make sense. And it sparks that curiosity. So, well, I'm so glad you got curious about sleep. Can you tell us about the relationships between sleep and weight?
Definitely. And this is a reason why I went later to get trained in obesity medicine, because as you might imagine, there's a ton of overlap between sleep and trouble maintaining weight. There's a ton of overlap between sleep apnea and people who are carrying extra weight, especially in their bellies, in their necks, in their chin. So I really wanted to understand better how to help people who are struggling with both conditions. I'll point out that when you think about ways to be a healthy human being, eating, sleeping, and what you eat for what you do for exercise are the three sort of tenets of health. And I would argue that without healthy sleep, you would have trouble making good food choices. I think a lot of us can relate. You don't really go to the refrigerator for cucumbers in the middle of the night. It's more like the ice cream. And for me, it's the thin mints when Girl Scout season is around. And with physical activity too, if your sleep is compromised, then you tend to be less motivated, less active. You're more susceptible to the couch melt with the Netflix on repeat at night. So sleep is foundational for health. And you and I had talked before a little bit about the ways that circadian rhythm plays a role in this. Should I elaborate on that a little bit?
Oh my gosh, yes. The circadian rhythm stuff is fascinating to me. Yeah, let's talk about it.
Yeah. So, you know, we're all human beings who are going around on this sphere in the universe, and we're essentially programmed to respond to the sun and the light dark cycle and the seasons. So light is called the primary Zeitgeber. Zeitgeber means time giver. And that light goes through our eyes to a specialized group of cells in the back of our retina that communicate directly with the central body clock, the suprachiasmatic nucleus. Most people have heard about the SCN, but what a lot of people don't know is that that's the master clock, but there's all kinds of peripheral clocks in every organ system, even adipose tissue, okay? So leptin, for example, is a hormone associated with satiety. And if you're a person who tends to be very regular with your sleep and wake schedule, then leptin will be appropriately high overnight, which is great because you don't have that hunger signal driving to eat food in the middle of the night. That's normal. And adiponectin is on the opposite phase. So adiponectin is low overnight. That's if you're keeping your rhythms regular. So there's an analogy I like to make with a symphony. Okay, so the master clock is like the conductor of the symphony, and it's sort of in control of the instruments. But everybody who's playing an instrument has a mind of their own. And when your circadian rhythm is out of phase, whether it be with light exposure, with meal timing, with physical activity or socialization, all of these things can start to go wonky. And then you've got the tuba coming in at the wrong time, or the violin sort of making a shriek instead of playing harmoniously. So you need to have all your instruments playing when they're supposed to play to get a harmonious sound, and also so that your body can predict what it should do next. And that includes digestion.
Wow. Okay. That was a lot of information. So let's talk about timing with food, maybe in particular. So one of the trends in the last few years has been intermittent fasting or time-restricted eating, where people, you know, limit the hours in the day where they eat, or have other timing structures around eating. What is the role of sort of, you know, the circadian rhythm and the clock when it comes to our eating patterns?
This is a really clever question because I think there's two underlying themes here. So I love the intermittent fasting idea. It works for some people. It happens to work for me. Mm-hmm. And there's been some data about this where people's food timing and meal timing, even caloric intake, has been controlled in studies. And what's been shown is that if you're going to intermittent fast, there seems to be a slight advantage to a 16-8 schedule where you're fasting for 16 hours and then your fed window is an 8-hour window, 16-8. And then your eating window in the morning seems to be slightly advantageous compared to having your window in the evening, so noon and an evening meal.
Yeah. And that's what I see clinically. If someone is going to intermittent fast, I recommend that they don't skip breakfast. We have a fair amount of data that people who eat breakfast maintain their weight better. And so I've always kind of felt like that was at odds with a lot of people skipping breakfast to do intermittent fasting. But if you can finish eating earlier in the day, that might be a strategy that works for some people. Okay, now I'm excited about circadian rhythm. I know we have other stuff to talk about, but I have another question about that. People have sort of different rhythms, right? I'm thinking of sort of the classic like lark or morning person versus like the night owl. And like, how important is it to sort of recognize your own rhythm a little bit and work within that? Or is that a myth? Are there not different rhythms?
No, that is true. And about 65% of people are third birds, which is in between the lark and the owl chronotype. I happen to be an extreme early bird, and then there are also extreme night owls. And when you're a night owl, I guess, so when you're at odds with your work schedule or society, then you kind of run into friction caused by your circadian rhythm. But you can do some things to mitigate that, one of which is to keep your clocks sort of synchronized in the schedule that you want to maintain.
So don't alternate, like don't flip-flop, don't get up early for work all week and then sleep in until noon on the weekends.
Exactly right. Yes. And you're essentially giving your body jet lag when you do that. I think people underestimate the ability of that difference in their sleep schedule to affect them. But if you're someone who prefers to sleep in on the weekends, it may feel quite luxurious. It may feel like a treat because that's more in line with your rhythm. But if you've got an early start on Monday, that can be pretty painful.
Right. It's like up and down. It's kind of like with nutrition. We don't want to, you know, be really strict with our nutrition plan all week and then do whatever the heck we want on the weekends, right? Like that's just going to yo-yo your body so much, you're probably not going to see a lot of results nutrition-wise. And so same thing with sleep habits. It sounds like being on that consistent schedule is pretty powerful for our body. I had to train my body to be on that consistent schedule that was early for med school and residency. I mean, like doctors love to start their day at like 5 and 6 in the morning. So you definitely can train your body, but yeah, you have to be consistent with it. That's sleeping until 10 or noon went out the window for me a long time ago. Okay. I have one more question on something that you talked about, which is the effect of light, because this is something I bring up with my patients. And I think that like, we need like a surgeon general warning about the effect that all this light has on us, especially as we are all looking at screens and tablets. Can you tell us a little bit more about how that can affect us on a daily basis with our sleep?
Yes, it's a great question because the electronic screen puts out primarily a short wavelength blue light, which is a signal for wakefulness. And I find that a lot of people sort of hypnotize themselves with their phones at night. Mm-hmm. It's something that I coach on a lot because when you can't sleep, it's uncomfortable, right? You're laying there with your thoughts and your feelings, and it's dark and quiet. And if you have some discomfort with that, it's quite easy to just reach back on the bedside table and start scrolling on your phone. So you're getting that blue light exposure that for some people prevents them from sleeping, and they tend to stay up later because time kind of slips through your fingers when you're in that scroll mode. For other people, they're able to get to sleep okay, but if I were to have EEG electrodes on their scalp, I would see that their sleep would be broken. Okay, So micro arousals during the night as a result of that blue light exposure, leading to interrupted sleep quality and effects the next day. Another thing that's a little bit interesting about circadian rhythm and light exposure is that the frontal lobes sort of expire their ability to put a negative effect on your amygdala after 16 hours. In other words, your frontal lobes are kind of keeping your amygdala in check over the course of the day. And that kind of evaporates with tiredness at night. So you're more negative at night. You're more likely to take things personally. You're more likely to ruminate over a comment or, you know, something that you saw on your phone. So there's that emotional agitation that people are more susceptible to. And that applies to nighttime awakenings as well.
That's fascinating. I've actually never heard that scientific explanation, but literally your brain cannot control your emotions as well after like 16 hours or so. It's just kind of done. Wow. That is super fascinating. I knew that was my threshold in residency. Like around 16 hours, I was like, I can't be a productive person anymore. Like I'd just be like staring at my computer screen. Like, what was I supposed to be doing?
I've been there too. And it's so painful, right? To be sleepy and to have work in front of you, that's really uncomfortable.
Yeah, we have to recognize the limits of what our body can do. You know, we can only, you know, run for so long. We can only go so long without food or drink. And we can only go so long without sleep. It's just a reality of being a human. So shifting gears a little bit, sleep apnea is something that I see a lot of my patients have. And I've always talked about this sort of chicken and egg relationship between sleep apnea and weight. But let's take a step back and just talk about what sleep apnea is. How do you explain sleep apnea to your patients?
So when I see people who are coming to me concerned that they might have sleep apnea or maybe their doctor is, I do like to go through and explain exactly what's happening so that they understand how important it is to get evaluated. So sleep apnea, especially obstructive sleep apnea, which is by far the most common type, means that you are literally blocking your airway during sleep. And that restriction means that you're not breathing well. So in addition to being a sleep disorder, it's also a breathing disorder. And when I say that, it can get people's attention because you want your breathing disorder treated, right?
Right. We all know breathing's important.
Yeah. So when you go to sleep, the muscles around the airway collapse because all your muscles are relaxed, especially during REM sleep or dream sleep, but also during non-REM sleep. That muscle collapse can cause the throat tissues to sort of cave in on the airway. Snoring is when you're moving air past that airway and the tissues are vibrating against one another. That can be a symptom of obstructive sleep apnea. But obstructive sleep apnea is really defined as problems with breathing that are occurring in episodes throughout the night, at least 10 seconds in duration, either causing a drop in blood oxygen level of 4% or more from baseline, or an arousal or awakening from sleep, so sleep disruption. So the two main problems with obstructive sleep apnea are drops in blood oxygen level, no bueno, and sleep disruption. These two things cause stress and inflammation in the body, and that's why it's important to figure out if you've got it.
And then what is the relationship between the sleep apnea, the obstructive sleep apnea, and weight? Because oftentimes, you know, people are told that one of the treatments for their obstructive sleep apnea is weight loss. What is that relationship and how likely is it that weight loss is going to help? How much weight would someone need to lose? What information can you tell us about the relationship between weight and sleep apnea?
I first want to dispel the myth that when someone has obstructive sleep apnea, it is because they're overweight or struggling with obesity. This is not necessarily the only factor contributing to obstructive sleep apnea. In fact, about 20% of people diagnosed with OSA are not overweight or struggling with obesity. So there are other factors like neurorespiratory control of breathing, your sex hormones, your age. These also contribute to risk. And because of that, weight loss does not always equal absence of sleep apnea. So I always recommend people get rechecked after losing a significant amount of weight, because if you still have residual obstructive sleep apnea, that can hamstring continued efforts at weight loss or even weight maintenance.
Yeah. And just your general health, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah. So I think that that is something that is a pretty common assumption or maybe myth that if you have lost weight, you've got to your goal weight, you've lost 10, 15, 20% of your weight, that your sleep apnea goes away. It could, it often can make it go away, but we shouldn't assume that. We should get it retested. We should be aware of symptoms. And if you are a, you know, normal weight, you still could have sleep apnea.
For sure.
If you're having fatigue, if you're not getting good quality sleep, if someone complains that you're having these apneas, they've heard you, like, you should get that checked out regardless of your weight. They don't have to go together.
Yeah. And I can pair that with a few stats. So if a person has a body mass index of 40 or above, the chances that they also have obstructive sleep apnea are somewhere between 50 and 98%.
Wow.
So no kidding, there has been a study showing 98% chance of having obstructive sleep apnea. So at this point in time, obstructive sleep apnea is massively underdiagnosed. About 80% of people who have obstructive sleep apnea are not diagnosed.
Wow.
And so anybody who's struggling with a high BMI like that may be sort of sabotaging their efforts at weight loss because they've got a sleep disorder that they don't know about. So I think it's really important for people to just have that awareness and also to know, and I'm going to say this, even though we didn't kind of touch on this, the treatments for obstructive sleep apnea are CPAP or something else. There are other treatments. It's a personal choice. It also has to do with severity of sleep apnea. But one of the points of resistance that I hear about is that somebody comes to see me and they feel like it's a given they're going to have CPAP at the end of their sleep evaluation. That is not the case. I think opening up to other alternatives is really valuable. And that's a discussion that I like to have with people.
Yeah. So if someone is not familiar with this, though, I think sleep apnea is pretty well known to people at this point. You know, most people know someone who wears a CPAP mask at night to help them breathe, help push air in overnight. But even as a family physician, you know, that's my assumption that most of my patients are going to end up with CPAP, that that's probably what they're going to do. So what are some of those other treatments for sleep apnea for people who the thought of a CPAP? Because I will admit, like, the thought of wearing a CPAP at night sounds very challenging to me. I would not be very excited about that. It would take a lot of work for me to wear that at night. I am the princess in the pee when it comes to sleep. So what are some of those alternatives for people who, you know, would not or are not able to use that treatment?
Yeah. So first I'll say that CPAP is the gold standard. And the reason it is because it's better than 95% effective.
So it works really well.
It works really well. The pressure can be customized, but the major caveat is it doesn't work if you don't use it. So that's the big deal, right? And the CPAP mask is usually the pain point. I get it. I have actually a whole course with group coaching for the CPAP mask problems. But when it comes to alternatives, you know, there's kind of this major decision point that a person needs to get, which is, do I want a non-surgical treatment or do I want a surgical treatment? And I'll say a little bit about both. With the non-surgical treatment, the primary modality is oral appliance therapy, also known as a mandibular advancement device. So the idea here is that you have a custom-made oral appliance, which fits on your lower teeth and upper teeth, and the two pieces engage to bring your jaw forward. And the hope is that that pulls your tongue mainly out of the airway enough so that breathing is now unobstructed. Always a great idea to have a sleep study after the oral appliance is made, though, because it doesn't work in all cases. So that's the mainstay for CPAP alternatives that are non-surgical. Another, when you look at surgical treatments, the primary one is Inspire. Is that something that you've heard of before?
I've heard a little bit about it, but my guess is that most people haven't. So tell us about the Inspire.
Yeah. So Inspire is a company that's here in Minnesota. And let me tell you, they've got a strong marketing game. So they are on the radio every time I turn it on. But with the Inspire implant, you're doing sort of a pacemaker-like device that's put in the upper right chest. They save the left chest for a pacemaker.
Gotcha.
And there's an electrode that is monitoring breathing and a second electrode that's snaked up into the base of the tongue to go around the genioglossus muscle. And it will push the tongue forward in sync with your breathing at night. And that is something you can feel. So it's not good for people who have insomnia in addition to sleep apnea, but people can benefit from that. And it can also be titrated for effect. Now, I like to say to people, you know, there's surgeries out there, there's Inspire, there's debulking procedures and such. And the thing about a surgery is that even though it may not be 100% effective, it's still with you every night. Mm-hmm. So it's something that you can take advantage of almost automatically sometimes. And I think that means something. So oftentimes I'll recommend combination therapies. Do they need a surgery plus CPAP at a lower pressure? Do they need CPAP plus oral appliance treatment? Is there a way that we could work it so that this person's sleep can be entirely healthy? And that's really important.
I love it. It's so comprehensive, you know, and so huge value to what you're adding. Now you're making me think I should refer to sleep specialists a lot more.
I mean, that can be an issue too, honestly. People wait 3 and 4 months to see somebody. So, you know, we're really being overrun, but I think with home sleep apnea testing, that's going to get better.
Right. Where you're saying there's so many people who have this undiagnosed and people already have 3 to 4 month waits. So we have to figure out who really needs to see the sleep specialist and who can, you know, do the home sleep study and start CPAP and then, you know, see a specialist if that is not working well for them. So you have a sleep summit coming up, which is an educational program for the public about sleep. Can you tell us about this sleep summit?
I'm super excited about it. So the sleep summit is an online summit that's happening February 6th through the 13th. So it's a week long. And I am the host and I interview all kinds of experts in the field, not just sleep medicine and cognitive behavioral therapy, but also cardiologists, ENT surgeons, diabetes specialists, all of these things that are tangent to sleep health, because I'm focusing on obstructive sleep apnea and insomnia to try to get the message out there that these conditions can be treated, and here's how we're going to do it, and here's how you access treatment in your area. So I think it'll be really beneficial for anybody who has those conditions, and the truth is, a lot of times they coexist within the same person. So this is a free summit. I would love people to sign up and get all the information they need, especially if you're wondering if you should get tested or you wonder where to go for treatment.
Awesome. And we'll make sure that the link for the sleep summit is in those show notes so people can find that and register for that free educational program. I've learned a ton chatting with you today, so I can't even imagine how many wonderful take-home points there's going to be in a full summit about sleep. Where else can people find you if they want information, want to learn more about sleep and what you do and how they can get better sleep?
Yeah. So I hang out at my website a lot. It's supersleepmd.com. There's a contact form there. It tells how to work with me. It tells about my 4 courses and my group coaching. And I do want to circle back and say thank you for being one of the guest experts for my sleep summit in February. I think it's really important to bring the information to people who need it. And you did such a great job talking about treatments in obesity medicine.
Thank you. Yeah, I was so happy to be a part of it. So, you know, we only get better at all these things by sharing our knowledge, right? And I've had some really interesting guests recently where I'm like, man, I get to learn stuff on this podcast. I didn't actually know that was going to be part of this. So always so exciting to learn. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. We'll make sure all of that ends up in the show notes. And until next week, take care.
Thank you for listening to the Dr. Francavilla Show, where we learn about all things related to weight and health. If you love this podcast, make sure to leave those 5-star reviews and share this podcast with a friend or loved one. If you have a topic about weight and health you want me to tackle, head over to the website, thedrfrankavillashow.com, to submit your question. And make sure to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss next week's episode. Take care.